Once again, I will be reading today from Catherine S. White's Onward and Upward in the Garden. And once again, this is the introduction written by her husband, E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web. In this issue of the March 1st, 1958, under the heading Books, The New Yorker ran a critical article on garden catalogs. It was signed Catherine S. White, its subhead being Onward and Upward in the Garden, and it was the first of what was to become a series of 14 garden pieces extending over a period of 12 years. To readers of the magazine, the first piece came as a surprise, I think a pleasant one. Innovative in that its author, without warning or apology, plunged boldly into reviewing books of the seedsman, the nurseryman, and as though she were reviewing the latest novel. To the best of my knowledge, nobody had ever done this before in a magazine of general circulation. If the New Yorker's readers were surprised, imagine the condition of the seedsmen and nurserymen themselves. It must have been a dream come true for them to wake up and discover their precious catalogs and their purple prose were being examined by a critical mind in the pages of a well-regarded publication. Once having taken off, Catherine White lost no time in slipping into a critical mode. Quote, "Say you have a flower like the zinnia," she wrote. "Clean cut, of interesting, positive form, with formal petals that are so neatly and cunningly put together, and with colors so subtle yet clear that they have always been the delightful of the still life artist. Then look at the W. Attlee Burpee and Joseph Harris Company catalogs and see what the seedsmen are doing to zinnias." There followed a gentle rebuke directed at the trend toward making flowers bigger and fancier. From that moment, she was off and running. Seedsmen, hybridizers, nurserymen hung onto their hats and read about themselves, their triumphs, their failures, their conceits, their prose style, with a mixture of awe, thanksgiving, and skepticism. They were being scrutinized in public by a woman who, whatever else she was an opinionated gardener, a devoted lover of flowers and vegetables, and an addict of catalogs. She was also well along in years and had arrived at her opinions over a long period of time and after much gardening. In addition to surprising thousands of New Yorker readers and dozens of seedsmen, Catherine managed to startle a third party, me, her husband. I felt both surprise and apprehension at this curious and unexpected development. I had observed my wife as a gardener, but never thought of her as an authority on horticultural matters, though she clearly was a devotee. I did not regard her as a scientist, and I wondered whether she realized what she was getting into, but I did know that she need bow to no one in her love of flower and form and her devotion to the spirit and task of gardening. Writing for her was an agonizing ordeal. Writing is hard work for almost everyone. For Catherine, it was particularly hard because she was by temperament and profession an editor, not a writer. When she sat down to compose a magazine piece on gardening, faced with all the strictures and disciplines of formal composition and suffering the uneasiness that goes with critical expression in public print, this was something else again. Gone was the clear and steady stream. Catherine's act of composition often achieved the turbulence of a shootout. The editor in her fought the writer every inch of the way. The struggle was felt all through the house. She would write 8 or 10 words, then draw her gun and shoot them down. This made for slow and torturous going. It was simple warfare. The editor ready to nip the writer before she committed all the sins and errors that editors clearly foresaw. Occasionally, I ribbed her about the pain she inflicted on herself. "Just go ahead and write," I said. "Edit afterwards. There's plenty of time." My advice never had any effect on her. She fought herself with vigor and conviction from the first sentence to the last, drawing blood the whole way. I worried about her health, which was not good. Luckily, she always did her homework and never started to write anything until she knew what she was talking about. In bringing these pieces together in a book, I draw encouragement from a number of sources. First, she herself had hoped to bring out a garden book. She kept putting the matter off because she wanted to expand her existing articles and write one more piece, a reminiscence about gardens of her childhood. Second, a number of people whose judgment I had valued urged Catherine to put her material into a book. Marianne Moore was, I think, the first one to persuade her that the New Yorker pieces should be preserved between covers. Finally, when I got around to reading the articles, I discovered to my great joy that though they began 20 years ago, they still seemed fresh. There had been, of course, many changes in the cast of characters and the business firms, but there was a quality in her work that the years did not diminish. Her excitement at growing things, her belief in the worth of gardening, her fascination with the architects who were behind the catalogs, these were timeless. She held the whole world of flowers in a warm embrace. Her pieces were intensely personal and charged with emotion. To write of Catherine simply as a gardener would be like writing of Ben Franklin simply as a printer. Gardening was indeed part of her, but never her major interest, consuming all her thoughts and all her talents. She simply accepted the act of gardening as a natural thing to be occupied with in one's spare time, no matter where one was or how deeply involved in other affairs. "Although I have gardened all my life," she wrote to a reader in 1959, "I'm very much an amateur, and I'm only beginning to know a little about the many nurseries that specialize." Amateur she was, but although she lacked a special knowledge and background of science, she was bountifully endowed with strong feelings and sure taste for what was simple and good, and the excitement and the fun that came with the discovery. She had fierce loyalty to common gifts of nature, goldenrod, pussy willows, dandelions, violets, wildflowers. And she began evaluating the catalogs of the professionals. She was enchanted to find that these articulate nurserymen were not just names on a page, that they were live actors on her chosen stage. They were writers. They were opinionated and with personal bias. They fascinated her but failed to intimidate her. When Amos Pettingill, the sage of White Flower Farm, whose name sounded a bit too Dickensian for her taste, described in his catalog a French pussy willow as, quote, "not the unreliable wild pussy willow," this was too much for my New England wife. "What is unreliable, pray, about the native wild pussies?" she retorted. "I have found them trustworthy in every respect." I did not know at the time, and still don't know, what moved Catherine to write that first garden piece. Ever since I'd known her, she'd been surrounded by seed catalogs. In wintertime, by seedlings pushing up in flats in the spring, and she always had arranged bouquets for our house or apartment. Onward and Upward, her title, a phrase swiped from the Unitarian Creed, had often appeared in the New Yorker as a heading in other contexts. It was Catherine's invention, however, and it proved a happy choice of title for her adventure in garden writing. After 2 years of giving the catalogs an annual going over and assessing the prose style and idiosyncrasies of the writers, she set to work, Onward and Upward, exploring other aspects of the garden world, the history of gardens, the literature of gardens, the arranging of flowers, the herbalists, the trends and developments. Not only was she traditional by nature, Catherine showed a strong streak of parochialism in her approach to gardening. New England was what she knew as a child, and the roots of her ancestors were deep in the soil of Maine and Massachusetts. The things that grew in New England, therefore, were her correct. They occupied a special place in her heart, an authenticity not enjoyed by flowers that made the mistake of blooming in other sections of the country. In my bumbling way, I ran straight to the regional bias when I introduced a few camellia plants into the small greenhouse we had acquired. This was in the last years of her life, when her days were becoming increasingly dreary because of invalidism, and I was casting about for ways to give her a few scattered moments of pleasure against the somber backdrop of illness. I must have seen years before that she had written about camellias. Quote, "My eye admires them even while my taste rejects them. I live in an old New England farmhouse against which these lush blooms look out of period." I read it, I guess, but it must have gone out of my mind. So I sent off for several camellia plants, thinking to cheer her up. The plants arrived from the West Coast by Greyhound bus and soon came into bloom. Tiffany, Betty Sheffield, Supreme, Ville de Nance, and other handsome little things. Proud of myself, I would make a quick early trip to the greenhouse, come back with a single flower, put it in a tiny vase, and have it on the tray when I carried her breakfast up to her room. Just a small surprise, courtesy of the management. "Oh, how pretty," she would exclaim, but Catherine was never any good at concealing her true feelings. She would have been the world's worst poker player. I soon detected on these early morning visits a forced note in her voice. I could almost hear her muttering under her breath, "Now, what is a southern flower doing in my main bedroom?" Now I'll turn to Catherine's own writing after her husband's loving introduction, and you'll get a feeling for how she did indeed love visualizing the flower seeds that she would send for from the catalogs. For gardeners, this is a season of lists and callow hopefulness. Hundreds of thousands of bewitched readers are poring over their catalogs, making lists for their seed and plant orders, and dreaming their dreams. Catherine goes on to ponder the question of whether all change is good, and as you would imagine, she decides that especially in the matter of flowers, bigger is not always better. She had said at one point, "Now I like chrysanthemums, but why should zinnias be made to look like chrysanthemums?" And then she goes on to say, "It's not only these transmogrifications of old favorites that trouble me. I'm equally bothered by the onward and upward cry of the seedsmen and plant growers. Of course, this is nothing new. The trend since almost the beginning of time has been to grow things that are bigger and better. Better, I go for. To grow things, roses that bloom all summer, daylilies that stay open longer, lettuce that doesn't bolt, corn that will not wilt, string beans without strings. The hybridizers, with an assist, perhaps from the chemists, are responsible for all these blessings. But as for flowers, I've never been able to persuade myself that the biggest blooms are necessarily the most beautiful. The peace, the rose called peace, the rose of the century, one cataloger terms it. Everybody knows this huge rosy yellow rose, and nearly everybody admires it and tries to grow it, in spite of its lovely colors. Well, I don't like peace. Even a small vase full of peace roses is grotesque to me, and on the bush, the blossoms look to me like the cabbagey tenille roses of the Queen's croquet garden. The white ones Alice found the card gardeners hurriedly painting red against the arrival of the Queen. Lewis Carroll was prophetic. Today the garden men are quite as busy changing the color of flowers as they are changing their size and shape. This is an indication of Catherine's spirit and her strong opinions, and I look forward to reading from Onward and Upward in the Garden again. This is Helen Cannon. Thank you.